Monday, November 4th, 2013, and this is episode 41, holy cow, of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, I'm joined tonight by Mr. Andrew Callett.
Good evening. Does this mean that our podcast is going to go through a midlife crisis soon?
Yeah, I think we're looking at a Corvette right now.
All right. I was hoping Ferrari, but we could start with Corvette. That's fine.
Well, you know.
Anyway, good
maybe
evening.
Where you work, but
oh wait, I thought the podcast was funding this with our many okay. sponsors.
Yes, our sponsors. That's right. All right, as usual, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employer. And I want to start off today's podcast by conveying a couple of lessons that my good friend Bob, who works in incident response at a different company that I won't name, impressed upon me this past week. And I'm hoping that you can learn from some of these lessons, because I think, you know, Bob feels it's really important for people to understand and embrace these ideas. So number one, move your logs off of your servers and on to some other server that's pretty tightly access controlled. That's really very important.
Wait a minute. Is Bob saying that a bad guy might somehow manipulate log files?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely
that's
that.
Shocking.
Definitely that. And, you know, that bad guy could be one of your employees. It could be an outside attacker. It could be anybody. It's just really good practice to move your logs someplace else. And you know, by the way, once they're there, you can start looking at them, right?
You know, you could. I mean, if you want to be different.
If you want to be different, that's true. I mean, yeah. Most people just ignore them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. You know, until something happens.
Until something happens. But boy, by the way, you know, Bob did tell me if you have those logs somewhere else and something happens, it makes your life a whole lot easier.
I can imagine so.
Yeah. All right. The last thing he wanted to share, and, you know, this is really just good advice to everybody. And I would personally share this advice too, but I mean, I never actually seen this firsthand, but don't let your employees ever share passwords.
Wow.
Right?
Well, you know, there's a few cases I can think of where you could.
You know, okay.
Like a company Twitter account, right? Where your marketing folks all got to update Twitter to one feed.
Well, that's true.
But that's a rare, rare exception.
That's true.
It's a rare exception. Otherwise.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking like, you know, administrative accounts on server.
Wow. You
know, SA accounts, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, those are kind of important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sudo, you know, learn it, love it, you know, use it. It's an important thing. Not everybody needs to be rude, by the way. And if, by the way, I know this through personal experience, right? If anybody tells you, and this it comes up like every couple of years, and it's been coming up for, I don't know, a decade or more for me personally. If somebody says to you, oh, but, you know, we have to log in as root because, you know, we can't do sudo stuff. You know, we can't log in with a user account and automatically and all that stuff. That's a bunch of BS. You know, read up on it. You can do just about anything you can imagine using a shared account with sudo and individual accounts. No excuses.
All right then.
Yeah. Okay. So that was those were Bob's words of wisdom for the week.
They're good. Hey, yeah. Are you, before we get to the stories, are you going to B-Sides Atlanta?
I am going to B-Sides Atlanta.
All right, I will be there as well. So if any of our Atlanta area listeners are there, they should say hello.
Yeah, look us up. I'm the bald guy.
I'm the not bald guy.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
A blessing and a curse. I did my first ever, and this is kind of sad for how long I've been in InfoSec. I did my first ever call for paper submission to B-Sides Atlanta.
Really?
I did. And a talk about something I've been kicking around in my head a long time about what the risk management and sort of incident response stuff that the aviation industry does and what we can learn from that into the InfoSec world, which is a really not a very good elegant way of describing my talk. The good news is that it was not accepted, so I didn't actually have to write it. And now I could just go to talks. But then I saw the talks are on the agenda, and I'm like, yeah, they made the right call because these talks are all better than mine. But it's a talk I keep kicking around, and one of these days I'll have to actually start working on it and make it actually, you know, meaningful.
I think it's an excellent idea. I think there's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and just to be fair, I'm not saying that a server crash is equivalent to when people die in an aviation accident. But, you know, it could feel that way if you're the guy who's in trouble.
Well, I think the process that you might want to go through to deconstruct what happened and learn lessons from what happened and mm-hmm. apply mitigations so it doesn't happen again is very relevant.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff, and I don't want to eat up podcast time with it. But anyway, so B-Sides Atlanta, we'll be there. And I'm glad you're going. I didn't know you're going. So
be there, be square. Yeah, I got a ticket.
That's awesome. We will have to sync up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, so we're going to jump into stories. The first story I have for you tonight is from InfoWorld, and this is titled New Malware Variant Suggest Cyber Criminals Targeting SAP Users. And, you know, this is an interesting, possibly interesting turn of events, right? We see and we have seen Trojans for a long time, especially, you know, banking Trojans, really more targeting individual people, so people's bank accounts and things like that. We haven't seen a lot of very specific application focused Trojans in the business context. You know, we see things like poison ivy all the time, but we haven't seen things that specifically target a particular business application like SAP. And in this particular case, there's an antivirus company called Dr. Web who, I guess they're not a, you know, well-known name, but they detected a variant of a banking Trojan. And this banking Trojan detects whether SAP, the SAP client, is installed on the computer. And apparently it doesn't actually do anything other than that. But the thinking is that possibly this is kind of doing reconnaissance to figure out, you know, what the footprint is and whether, you know, a next turn of the crank would be profitable for the attackers here.
Yeah, because if you could get SAP data, that's some critical stuff there that you could do all sorts of nasty info with.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, or nasty things with that info.
Absolutely. There was an interesting talk at DerbyCon this year about, and I believe it was SAP. I'll have to go back and look, but the presenters were mucking with the ODBC connection to actually modify what the SAP client was communicating back and forth to the database server was pretty interesting. And I could see some.
So they were doing like a man in the middle attack between the clients and the server?
Yeah, with the ODBC connection on the workstation.
That's interesting.
Oh, it was pretty cool. Huh. was pretty cool. And they have, you know, proof of concept code, which, you know, hey, maybe that's what these guys are going to use.
And that's why researchers shouldn't release any code.
Never, ever.
I'm kidding.
All right. So anyway, I wanted to bring this up because, you know, I think we as security people in the corporate context have been kind of living on borrowed time. This is, at least in my mind, an inevitable turn of events, and we need to be ready for it. So moving on to Adobe. So there's been a lot of talk recently about what happened with Adobe, and I won't rehash it, but I will say that Adobe initially came out of the gate and said that 3.8 million accounts had been compromised. Well, it's actually more like 38 million.
Oops.
I mean, you know, it's probably just like a, you know, decimal place problem. I'm sure. Or maybe it's like the Europeans, how they use the dots instead of the commas.
I was thinking just, you know, Excel spreadsheet issue.
Well, that's true.
Widen the field wide enough.
That's true. I had to let someone go because I screwed up a budget in an Excel spreadsheet once. It was really unfortunate. Sorry, Bill, but, you know, I don't know how to use Excel.
These things happen. And, you know, it was an important, valuable lesson learned.
That's right. For everybody.
At his expense.
For everybody.
Anyway, so 38 million.
38 million.
But wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more. That's not what this story is about. This story is about something tangentially related. So the 38 million apparently was the number of credit cards stolen. And I mean encrypted credit cards. But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about their user accounts. So apparently this is like the rest of the Adobe property site. 130 million accounts and encrypted passwords were stolen. And, you know, hey, that happens all the time. I mean, 130 million is it's a big number, but whatever, right? Well, here's the rub. They didn't use a hashing function on their passwords. They used symmetric encryption.
But Jerry, that means that it's the same hash for all the passwords. You only have to break one and then you break them all. They couldn't possibly have done that.
Well, they did. And the point of this article is that if some enterprising attacker is able to figure out what password was used to encrypt these 130 million passwords, the job of password brute forcing is going to become a lot more interesting, because think about it, right? Password brute forcing right now is done using dictionaries built from all of these password disclosures. And I think that if you were to add all of them up previously, they might add up to this monumental cache of passwords.
Yeah, that's going to be a hell of a rainbow table that they can create.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess it's an unfortunate thing. And in the article, they point out that it's entirely possible that the people who raided this site and got the data, which, by the way, is really huge. It's like 9.3 gigs.
Wow.
worth of user data. I mean, that takes a while to download off your server.
Yeah, that's something, you know, to note right there is, you know, how do you not notice 9.3 gigs leaving your environment? Oh, wait, because you weren't watching.
Yes, you weren't watching.
So the lesson learned here is, you know, maybe, I don't know, go back to 1993 and learn how to encrypt your passwords properly.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, they actually are aware of the badness that this is and have been apparently moving, I guess, slowly over to an new environment that is, I guess, more appropriately treating their passwords, but obviously...
So not enough urgency. They got caught.
Yeah, not enough urgency.
Wow.
You know, I thought it was interesting. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this is a perfect example of, you know, there probably was a risk decision made of, we can't move people too quickly because it could possibly disrupt the business environment. And the marketing folks or whomever saying, well, you know, we've got this, we've got to move slow, we've got to move carefully, we've got to, whatever the consideration was, there's a whole spectrum between turn off the old thing and turn on the new thing, and everybody has to recreate their accounts, to very slowly transparent migration. And there's a whole spectrum in between.
Absolutely.
And this is a fascinating case of, you know, you never know when you're going to get popped, right? So it's, you know, you can't say that they knew this was coming, but they clearly moved too slowly in hindsight, which is always 2020. But this is that risk trade-off that we all have to decide on and make, and it's a very difficult one. But this, I think, is a perfect example of the business case of how much risk do you have in making the change versus how much risk do you have in not making the change,
Right.
and how do you make that risk slowly? So, not to go off on a bit of a mini rant here or anything, but I think that's a really interesting case study for that sort of thing.
No, I think you're on an excellent point. You know, I see a lot of business people talk about risk, and I really can't help but think, you know, on the one hand, they are conceptualizing what the risk is, but I really don't think they actually think it has any chance of actually happening. And so, you know, in this particular case, it would be really interesting to be a fly on the wall to figure out if, or to see if, you know, are they surprised that this risk, which they may very well have thought through, actually materialized?
Yeah. You know, again, hindsight's 2020, but
Yeah.
it'd be awesome if after this was all said and done, you know, whoever was in the know, you know, could be transparent about the decision-making process. I don't know that it'll ever happen, but it would be interesting.
Definitely, definitely. And I think if it is, you know, it's an opportunity for everybody to learn from. And, you know, I God, having been through troubles, obviously not like this or to this magnitude, but man, I really feel for these guys. It's
Oh
got to
yeah.
be hell.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, there's some the career limiting things going on right now. You know, but this is the reality of the world we're in though. There are bad guys and they want our stuff.
Yes. And by the way, they, you know, they've also, it's also come out that they took, you know, they took the source code for Photoshop and for Acrobat and Cold Fusion. And by the way, Cold Fusion apparently is the thing that, you know, people keep getting compromised with, and possibly including this one.
So I'd be curious to know what version of that code that is. How far back is it, right?
You
Because
know,
it may no longer be relevant.
there hasn't been any indication of that. I'm expecting at some point we'll find something out about that. But you know, the one thing, I've talked to some researchers in the past, and one of the things they pointed out is that from the perspective of finding vulnerabilities, source code is interesting. But you know, if you have a big product like Cold Fusion, you know, unless you have just a crap load of time to expend in doing, you know, a very, very thorough code review, it's often more productive to use, you know, just the basic fuzzers
Sure.
and whatnot against binaries.
You know, where it would be handy though is if you know that there's an area that you want to go after, you can go more easily find, you know, like unbounded inputs and potential overflows and,
Sure.
you know, very targeted. There are also tools though that are made specifically to go look at big code and find common issues.
Good point.
You know, but code nowadays is so complex and so difficult to, you know, see the big picture of who knows how some of these things are interacting with each other when it really all compiles together.
Yeah,
So who knows? I mean
absolutely.
that code might have been just, you know, something to sell. Who knows that it's actually going to get reverse engineered into malware attacks? That's what we're all assuming, but that may not be the case.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, we may not ever find out.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably most valuable to their competitors.
Exactly. Exactly. We'll find the Chinese competition to Photoshop soon. or Russian.
I'm not going to make all the racist jokes that suddenly came to mind.
Oh, dear. So let's, sounds like a good time to move on.
Indeed, please, before I'm banned from this corner of the internet as well.
So the next story comes from Quartz. And by the way, I never really got the memo that Quartz became a thing. But anyway, the story here is named or titled "The Complete Guide to Not Being That Idiot Who Got the Company Hacked."
And this hurt my brain.
Yeah. This sounds like a really good article. Like a really good article that everybody should read, except that when you start reading it, it's not such a good thing. So there's really a couple of things, and I don't want to drag everybody through the pain that this is, but I have to point out a few things that really bother me. And their first bullet is install HTTPS everywhere on your browser. And boy, that's a great idea.
Yeah, right? What's wrong with that?
But why? Why do you want to install HTTPS everywhere? Well, it's because if you use only sites that have HTTPS, they only store your passwords, in an encrypted hash.
So you're saying sites without HTTPS?
Obviously, they don't.
Right. Hang on, I gotta look up my website for dummies book here. Just give me a moment.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So. So I,
and for the record, I'm staying away from healthcare.gov comments. I could, but I'm not gonna.
I think I figured out how that all went down today.
This is a non-political show. Well, of course, it's a government contract.
You know, they spent $623.5 million in 2 years building this site. They got within 2 weeks, and they're like, holy crap, we don't have anything to show. What can we do with $500,000 in 2 weeks? And that's what we got.
Well, you know, project managers are expensive.
Well, that's true.
And you need a lot of project managers.
A lot. A lot. Yeah. And they help the project, right? I mean, they manage the project.
Well, of course. I mean, without a project manager, what would get done?
Nothing, obviously.
Hmm. Anyway.
So anyway, I digress.
HTTPS everywhere. Yeah.
That's the biggest steaming pile of poo that I've read since, what was that? Oh, I guess it was about a couple of weeks ago when we saw the story about the big Linux hack, right? So, yeah. And then farther down, let's see. Oh, encrypt your hard drives or your laptop's hard drive, especially if it's a Mac.
I couldn't understand that, especially if it's a Mac part.
Apparently, if it's Windows, I guess, Well, it says it's a little more involved, right?
I get the feeling the author uses Macs.
I think so. I think so. It's a little more involved. I mean, it says it right there. It's a little more involved. So obviously you wouldn't want to do it on your Windows system because it is a little more involved. But I would like to point out that it is my strong recommendation and my experience that you really, really want to encrypt every stinking laptop in your environment. Period. End of story.
I would concur.
And desktop too, by the way. Go to databreachdb.org and look through all the freaking records there, and you'll find case after case of small businesses being burglared and having their desktops taken. And oh my goodness, we didn't think we needed to encrypt the hard drive of a desktop that never leaves the building. It's sitting there, right?
Out of curiosity, which full disk encryption manufacturer do you have stock in?
TrueCrypt.
Yes. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. I actually meant that as a literal sense, as in owning stock of their company
I know. I own a very significant stake in TrueCrypt.
Oh, okay.
Moving on.
I have nothing to say to that.
The next two. You know, the next two, use one password. Actually, I take that back. Let me back up for a second. Number six was never send or save your password electronically. And wait. Then number seven was use one password to store your passwords electronically.
Okay, now let's be fair. This is written for a home user or a non-IT knowledgeable person, right?
But wait, I had that same thought. And then I went back and I read the title of the article again.
Yeah.
Let's read it together. The Complete Guide to Not Being That Idiot Who Got the Company Hacked.
Jerry, you see, when we write articles and we title them, we're trying to get attention. And what has this article title done?
Oh, fair enough. Damn it.
And now, what else are we doing? We're broadcasting it to all three of our listeners because your mom stopped listening. And see?
Oh, man. You're right. Let's move on.
But my mom listens twice, so it's okay.
Okay. I keep hoping that I can get my mom to start listening again.
Well, I don't think I'm going to add the recipe section that she wants. I don't see that happening.
All right.
Next. So clearly, this is not an article that we support, I think is what you're saying.
I think the correct word, to quote some British friends, it's rubbish.
Mm.
Yes, it's pure rubbish
that
belongs in the bin. Yes. All right. Next story. This comes to us from Dark Reading, and the title of it is Social Engineers Pwn the Human Network in Major Firms. And so earlier this year, and actually at every DEF CON for the past couple years, the fine people over at socialengineer.com run a social engineering capture the flag. And it's actually pretty cool. They produce a report every year after the festivities. And, you know, the point in this article was kind of recapping this year's CTF. And, well, the companies didn't do so well. And what I thought was really interesting about this was, you know, let me set this up for you, right? So the CTF kind of works like this. There's a big room at DEF CON, and up at the front on a stage is this soundproof glass booth. And they put the social engineer in the booth, close it up. He calls his target company, and his objective is to get flags out of the person they're calling. And the rest of the audience can actually hear, but obviously, you know, it's sound isolated, so the person on the phone can't hear what's going on out in the room, because that would probably be bad. But anyway, what I thought was pretty interesting is, you know, obviously it's really easy to fool people, right? But in this particular case, they scored most of their points. So as in capturing their flags, not during that call, but actually during the prep work. So one of the phases leading up to this, you know, in-person live demonstration is what they call intel gathering. And so they're allowed, the contestants are allowed to do research online. They're not allowed to do anything illegal, like hack the sites or whatever, but, you know, they can use Google, they can use whatever available on that company's website and whatnot. And what I found most disturbing is, you know, they're finding everything, and they're finding stuff that really effectively enables that phone call, right? So, you know, I can find a lot of stuff out about your organization from your website. And when I call one of your people, I can talk very intelligently about your company, and that puts them at ease and makes them feel like I know, or maybe I'm kind of part of the in, you know, I'm on the inside,
Yeah, this is one thing that we suck at as an industry. Social engineering is far too effective. And, you know, as it's shown here, I mean, even Apple, who's notorious for having good, you know, operational security around their competitive information and pertinent information, gave up a ton of IT security information. And I think we just suck at this. I think humans are bad at knowing about this kind of stuff, which is why social engineering works. It's very easy to be adaptable. It's very easy to keep trying different things until you get what you need. And we don't do a good job of training our users to making them suspicious. And because people want to be helpful. And it's, you know, it's one of those areas that I don't think it's as sexy because, frankly, there isn't a vendor out there selling a box that fixes social engineering.
No,
So
that's exactly right.
you're not getting a lot of Gartner case studies on it, and you're not getting Magic Quadrants, and you're not getting, you know, people giving you presos every day and talks every day about how to use, you know, widget X to stop social engineering. So it's sort of one of these areas that doesn't get a lot of attention. And I think it's a huge area of weakness, and it's a big blind spot.
But you know, one of the things we can do, obviously, other than training, which only has so much ability to be effective, is be mindful about what we put out in
Oh,
the
yeah.
public domain.
Job listings are a wonderful source of information. If I want to know what kind of security technology you're running, I go watch your job listings for your IT department. It will list all of the technology you expect your applicant to be able to be familiar with.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really great point. LinkedIn is
Oh, yeah.
just an amazing resource. I remember in the wake of the initial Snowden releases, people started trolling LinkedIn, searching for some of the code names. And
Right.
at the time, they were kind of no, you know, there's no context behind some of these code names. And here, now that we know what they are, we find all of these contractors and former government agents and whatnot listing their involvement in these programs kind of in the wide open. I was
Right.
really, really shocked.
Yeah, and that's a great point, right? You never know when that piece of open source intel becomes connected to something else that makes it valuable, right? You can never predict the future. Now, I'll say that I'm just as guilty as anybody else, right? I'm out on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and, you know, whatever, and
Running a podcast.
oh, shit.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about that. Anyway, but you know, this comes back to corporate identity, corporate information. Let's not make it easier for the bad guys. Or at the same time, you can take the other route entirely, which is assume all of this is out there and how are you going to defend yourself anyway. But nonetheless, it's one of those things that I think it shows over and over again that it's really easy to get this sort of information. You know, they look, and this, I don't know if you mentioned this, but they're going after things like, you know, what type of operating system are you running? What type of browser are you running? What's your malware, anti-malware software? And the key one is getting people to click on rigged sites, which is huge. And, you know, the one that I found interesting too is, do you have a cafeteria on site? Because then they could do more physical entry, looking like a cafeteria worker or whatever it may be. It's huge. It's an area that we probably need to do a better job talking to our users about.
Yeah, there was one guy who they didn't name which organization he targeted, but apparently he found substantial information to enable him to actually be able to log in to the company's intranet. He found that information posted on their public website.
Wow. You know, the other thing I can say is that, you know, if you think your company's immune from this, the next time you have a good security audit done by a third party, have them do a social engineering component or an open security or open
Absolutely.
intelligence component, and you will be shocked.
Absolutely.
You know, make sure it's a good, reputable consulting firm. You know, not a fly-by-night operation who's just running a pen test suite against you, but people who have their stuff together, you will be shocked what can be found out. Then the question is, what are you going to do about it? because it's really tough once it's out there.
Absolutely. Completely agree. And I think, you know, I fear this is one of the things that is kind of untapped. You know, we talk a lot about, as you mentioned, right, we're very focused on technology, but man, the social aspect is, you know, really wide open, and there aren't a lot of good defenses.
Well, you know, but the NSA is monitoring all the phone calls, so maybe we could do something with that. We just mine it for good social engineering cues.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Hey, you know, this kind of dovetails very well into the next story, which is pretty cool. The title is actually from a story from ZDNet, right? So it's titled "Government Agency Compromised by Fake Facebook Hottie." Boy, you can tell this is going to be good. So, you know, when I read this, right, my first inclination, my first thought was, wow, what a train wreck. But, it's quite a long article. The summary is that a couple of researchers were hired to do a pen test. And this was, I would say, something of a unorthodox pen test, and it spanned quite some time. They set up a fake Facebook profile, and they used some pictures of a Hooters waitress at a restaurant near the people they were targeting, right? So they knew the people who they were targeting were familiar with, you know, this lady in physical appearance, and at least
certain parts of her.
At least certain parts of her, and I think at some point in the post here, it does say something about look at my eyes, but anyway, I digress. So they set up this fake profile, and they basically started building a relationship with these people, and they were really clever. They basically started, they built this profile. They faked that this person got a job at this government agency in a particular department. And obviously because she's so attractive, she basically kind of wormed her way in, and the people in this organization were all too willing to help her out. I mean, they were like falling over themselves, willing to, you know, to help her get a laptop, you know, they at some point after she was somewhat familiar to them, they had her send out some e-cards, which led to a site they had set up that, you know, beef hooked them. And then they took some control. They created some email addresses for her and internet accounts and whatnot. So, I mean, totally legitimized this lady within the organization. And, she never existed.
Yeah. You know, one thing too is they did a lot on LinkedIn as well, and yes, then started cross-linking between LinkedIn and Facebook. And they did some stuff where people reached out to her or she reached out to them, and they quote-unquote remembered her because she brought up connections that they garnered from open source intelligence about that person of, you know, oh, we worked together at XYZ. Oh, yeah, I remember that, you know, that kind of thing. And yes, so that are you saying
classic.
We should never trust attractive women? Is that what you're saying, Jerry?
Well, I'm just saying, you know, be skeptical, right?
Yeah, no, this is pretty epic. Now, this was obviously a take on the Robin Sage thing that happened back in 2009, which was pretty epic. But this definitely took it much, much further. And it was, you know, pretty cool, to build this level of access. Once again, this means follow the process. Right? If you're creating accounts for somebody, make sure that account creation came from, you know, the right people.
Absolutely. And I think that was, you know, that was one of the real eye openers here, was that people were so willing to help this attractive young lady, by circumventing the process.
And let's be clear, she got a company laptop.
Yes.
With login, valid network credentials, and elevated privileges above what her fictional role should have been.
Yes.
Think about that for a second.
Right. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Just because she was an attractive looking lady.
And said she worked there.
And said she worked there.
Right. Yep. They never hacked HR. They never did anything other than created these fake social media accounts. And then just went from there.
So there were a couple of, actually all the slides and whatnot are available because they presented the output of this at a conference. And there was a summary slide in here, and I wanted to kind of go through their bullet points of what this incident taught, right? Number one was that identities are a valuable commodity. And obviously that is, you know, pretty true here, where, you know, we intrinsically, and I guess this kind of goes to the next, you know, the next bullet, which is humans are naturally trusting, right? Especially when we see some kind of history here, that identity becomes kind of self-validating, and it helps trust what we're seeing. You know, it's just endemic in people. The next item was that people use the same password for everything, and that shouldn't come as a surprise. Attractive women get special treatment in a male-dominated industry. You know, that shouldn't come as any surprise either. But, you know, this is not a new thing. I mean, this is something that the intelligence world has known for a very, very long time. That,
yep,
you know, you just get some attractive young lady and, you know, you can get the crusty old guys to do whatever you want.
Did you just call me crusty?
Well, yeah, sorry to break it to you.
Well, you know, the important thing for me is that I have such low self-esteem that I know no attractive girl would ever actually want anything from me. So I'm immediately suspect whenever an attractive girl is nice to me. Immediately. Well, that is the value of low self-esteem right there.
There you go. There you go. So, you know, if you have young children, you know, here's your opportunity. Teach them well.
I didn't know where we were going with that. I was a little concerned.
Teach them well. I don't mean you. I mean the listeners, right?
Right.
Teach them well.
All right.
Apparently, low self-esteem is a good attribute.
Well, in terms of social engineering.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. All right. Next one was common security products will not protect you from social engineering.
Yeah,
you talked about that a minute ago. Social engineering threats can impact your business. Yep, pretty straightforward. And there isn't a silver bullet product that can protect you from a future Emily Williams. Emily Williams was the name of the fictional character here. And you know, I think that's pretty self-explanatory.
Because one thing we didn't mention was their ultimate prize here was once they had all this set up, when they got people to click on the fake holiday cards, they used that to gain administrative rights,
yes,
obtain passwords, install applications, steal documents with sensitive information, some of which they said included information about state-sponsored attacks and country leaders, right? So they took this all the way to really getting some gold here.
They had completely and utterly own this organization from top to bottom with this fake account. I mean, it was really devastating if this had not been some good guys. Now, I did notice some irregularities in the story. So, for instance, they said that one of the IDs that got was a Salesforce login, which, you know, I don't know if they're mixing stories here, but I don't know a lot of government agencies that use Salesforce.com. But, you know, hey, whatever. You know, that there was a really good point at the bottom, and I wanted to read it here because I thought it was pretty important. Social engineering trainings aren't ever going to be enough if employees don't have an understanding of constant situational awareness. And, you know, that's what it's all about. If you don't, as a, you know, as somebody in a position of authority, like being able to create an account or ship a laptop or what have you, if you're not aware of your situation and the possibility that somebody's playing you, this is going to happen.
Yeah. And I think the key thing is situational awareness, right? You know, once again, I'm seeing all the parallels back to the world of military warfare and, you know, counterintelligence and intelligence, that they learned all these lessons a long time ago. And we seem to not have translated this well into the world of business security.
Absolutely. Okay. So enough of that happy story. Next, we're going to move on. You know, Halloween is behind us, but, you know, here's our ghost story. Here's our IT ghost story. And we mentioned this very briefly last week, but, you know, since then, holy moly, has there been a lot of hoopla about this story. And what we're talking about is bad BIOS.
You know, growing up, my mom told me if I didn't eat all my vegetables, bad BIOS was going to get me.
And here it is.
So let me say right up front, I am not siding one way or the other. The jury's still out for me, but I find this fascinating and educational.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, I was having some discussions with different people out in the industry. And, you know, the thinking is that if this thing doesn't currently exist, somebody's now trying to make it.
So what's really interesting here, and this is the first time I know that we've done this on the show, is we have a great introduction and description from Robert Graham about what bad BIOS is, and we'll get into that. But we also have a story that completely rips that analysis to pieces and all the conjecture around it, and you know, says that all this stuff going on with this is completely wrong.
Yep. So, well, you know, I wanted to be like Fox News, you know, whole fair and balanced thing, right?
So what's interesting, so the background on this, and we could spend a lot of time on this, but we won't, because it's really something you should go and read and learn. But it's a guy by the name of Dan Gooden, who is well-known in the industry, well-respected, been around a long time, done a lot of valid security research, not a fly-by-night guy. Long story short, thinks he's found and has been researching for the last 3 years this crazy powerful BIOS-level malware that is really difficult to eradicate and can do everything like passing itself via USB and rewriting BIOSes, to using speakers and microphones to cross air gaps to other devices, amongst other really crazy powerful capabilities.
Yes. So one thing I just wanted to correct real quick. Dan Gooden is the guy that wrote an article.
Oh, you're right. I'm so sorry.
On Ars Technica. The guy who's doing this is allegedly uncovering this is named Dragos Rue. And Dragos, if you may know him, he's the guy that started CanSec West.
Right.
And he's also the guy that started the Pwn to Own contest. So
now I feel silly.
Well, he's not like a, he's not like a, well, I know, you know, it's easy.
Yeah, I'm just looking at names and, but the background still applies. He's well known, well respected, just had the name wrong. Sorry.
Absolutely. So I linked to Rob Graham's description rather than to Dragos' description because I thought it did a better job of kind of going through the different points, right? So the net of it is that, again, Dragos is you already said, right? Dragos has, in his lab, seen an infection that has permeated his systems, and it's crossed apparently from some Macs to some OpenBSD systems, and I think also to some Windows systems. And there's some unique and peculiar features of this. So one of them was that the infection appears to persist after system reinstalls, right? So he, you know, he reimages the system and doesn't connect it to the network, but the system becomes reinfected. So yeah, that's an interesting feature. He has also observed that it apparently interrupts the infected system's ability to boot off of a CD. So that's interesting. Another is that he believes it is, at a very low level, modifying USB drives, the controllers on USB drives. And if you do an unclean removal of the USB drive from an infected computer, and you try to use that in a different computer, it's totally unreadable. But if you go and you put it back into the infected computer, and you do a clean removal, and then try to put it into a different computer, it works okay again. So that the hypothesis there is that the malware is doing something with the controller inside the USB drive. So not actually mucking with the file system or the files on the device, but the actual controller. And that's what's, rendering it unreadable in a different system.
Yeah, it's some crazy stuff. To be clear, Dragos has been very upfront about not knowing what's going on. He's not, sort of doing much other than bringing this to the world and saying, weird stuff is happening. And he's being very sort of humble about it and doing the right thing of not jumping to too many conclusions. And so there's a lot of unknowns about this right now. So many things, early reports could be faulty. This is not a research, peer-reviewed released paper or anything. It's a interesting thing in flight right now that is fascinating to watch.
So there was another aspect that I wanted to mention, and you mentioned it, and it was the ability to jump air gaps. And so the air gap jumping is apparently done with the speaker and microphone. Again, is assuming everything we know is true. Dragos has said that he took one of his systems, and he was, he believed the system was infected, and he was seeing network traffic. So he unplugged the network, turned off the Wi-Fi, disabled the Bluetooth, and he still continued to see network traffic. And so he even went so far as to unplug, the power cable. I guess it was a laptop. And he still continued to see network traffic.
Now, to be clear, the laptop was still on, running on battery power.
Correct.
Yeah.
And he did not see the network traffic stop until he snipped the microphone and speaker wire.
Which could be an amazing coincidence.
Which could be a coincidence. No doubt about it, right? But now, the point about Rob Graham's article, and, both, you and I worked with Rob Graham, and so I've got a lot of respect for him. He's a smart guy. He points out that really no part of this is an impossibility. It is possible to do low bandwidth communications with a microphone and a speaker between two computers. When I personally was in high school, I did this, right?
I was just going to bring that up. Acoustic couplers with modems. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I had two 6502 PC breadboards, and, I interfaced them with LEDs, and I interfaced them with microphones and speakers, and it was ugly and it was noisy, but you know what? It worked, and I was a freaking dumbass high school kid. This could work, right? Now, we'll flip over to the other side, which was an article written by, I don't remember. Anyway, Root Worms Corner is the name of the blog, right? So this blog, he apparently is a fairly experienced BIOS writer, right? And the net of his problem is that BIOS and motherboards are so unique that it's almost unfathomable that you could create a piece of malware that would be portable across different devices. So it's not in his mind possible to write a BIOS level piece of malware that would work on a Mac and on really any other piece of hardware. And in fact, he goes so far as to say you really couldn't expect to get that piece of malware to work like even on just a minor revision of the same brand of motherboard because there's so many nuances.
For the record, it was written by Philip Yannick.
Thank you.
Sure.
Now, there has been some criticism of his criticism in that, he basically is saying, this isn't possible. It's totally impossible because I don't know how it could be done.
Yeah, and that's the only challenge I have with his article, though. He's really good at bringing up some facts. Then he goes immediately to, and because A equals B, therefore A must equal C, without necessarily fully defending his argument. But he does bring up some really interesting points of why certain conjectures aren't working based on his low-level understanding of some of this technology that admittedly probably a lot of the InfoSec community doesn't understand. But then he's sometimes a little too declarative of why things couldn't possibly happen, and then that sometimes hurts credibility of, maybe. It could happen, but it's really, really difficult. Right. But I'll tell you, I learned a ton reading his rebuttal.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And lots of good stuff in here.
You know, I think the point is, and if there is truth, right, it's going to be somewhere in the middle, because I think there probably are some aspects of what he says that are hard and fast truth. But it makes me wonder, are there other aspects, are there other possibilities that could explain how this might happen that, he's not taking into account in his analysis of writing the BIOS. I don't know. I don't know enough about this. He's way smarter about low-level, BIOS and whatnot than I probably ever will be. So you kind of have to trust him. But, I'm really interested to find out what actually is going on. I really, really hope Dragos at some point invites other people into his lab so that there's some, some independent corroboration or disapproval, because, this is really a bizarre story. And like I said, if nothing else, man, those guys at the NSA, they probably got a whole new project now.
Yeah, no kidding. It's a fascinating little thing. And, and we'll see. Ultimately, this may be much ado about nothing, but it's fun watching the industry as a group rip this apart, look at it, figure it out. And, it's a fun little project for a lot of folks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, we'll see. Well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to say about this. I really don't necessarily think that Dragos is intentionally trying to deceive people. I won't admit to knowing Dragos personally, but I know his reputation, and it seems like there's probably some amount of truth to some parts of this, if it is indeed not all true.
Right.
So, well, amazingly, we're at an hour, so I think we're just about out of time. I think next week we'll pick back up with the attack of the week, and I think we're going to do part two of advanced malware and a few other fun things. In the meantime, I wanted to tell everybody about a great book I just finished reading, and it is not about InfoSec at all. The name of the book is Predictably Irrational, by a guy named Dan Ehrlich. And it's really awesome. It is on the topic of behavioral economics, which you may have heard of. And I bring it up to this audience here because it really gets into the psychology behind why people do the things they do and in particular, a lot of things about why people are dishonest, and what things people can do to fight the urge to be dishonest. And you know, when you read it, it's very eye-opening that some of this stuff is just very endemic in people generally, obviously to different levels, and different kinds of people will do it in different contexts. But it's just a great book, and I've been really thinking a lot about how this is applicable. You know, so is there a behavioral economic slant to why people pick bad passwords? Is there a slant to why they will commit fraud? And you know, I could probably do a whole episode just about this, right? But, you know, some of the things that are uncovered are experiments that prove that people, when you remove them from money, they become much more comfortable with stealing, right? And so, you know, you might not see a person walk by and pick up, you know, a pile of cash, right? But if they can take something that represents cash, they often suddenly become okay with it. And so it's fascinating stuff. And I encourage everybody to read it because, you know, not only from the information security context is it really relevant, but man, just as a life lesson, it really answers a lot of questions about, you know, why people are interested in sales, and you start to get marketing now. And so anyway, it's a fun book. I couldn't stop reading it. Once I started reading it, I found myself reading it everywhere. So until I finished it, there's two more books in the series. So I'm, you know, gonna read those next. But anyway, that was my book review for the week.
I just added it to my Amazon wish list. I will have to grab it and read it. I've got about 18 books in front of it right now, but it's on my list.
Yeah, it's fantastic. He's great. By the way, he also, it doesn't come up very often, but he apparently has a free class on Coursera, which I don't know if it's strictly based on the book or what, but my former boss took that class and said it was really, really good. So anyway, take a look at that. By the way, if you don't know about Coursera, go look it up. It's awesome, free. You know, you gotta be disciplined to stick with the homework, but man, it's pretty cool. We live in exciting times that you can take, you know, college classes at the top universities in the world for free from your house. How cool is that?
Well, you know, when you're not allowed to be around college-age women, that's what you have to do, Jerry.
Well, that's true. Well, actually, it's only specific ones.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, that wraps up the show. I appreciate everyone's time and attention. Hopefully, you find this useful. If you have any comments, questions, feedback, or if you would like us to talk about anything in particular, please drop us a line to info@defensivesecurity.org. You can hit us up on Twitter @defensivesec. You can find Mr. Kellett on Twitter @lurg. You can find me on Twitter @malicious_link. The website for the podcast is www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find show notes and lots of other fun stuff on that site. And with that, I bid you adieu. I hope you have a great week. Take care.